Welcome to Starving Universe On Call. I am Paul France, owner of France Games. I'm an SFB Online, FedCom Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Just a reminder, how to join us for a talk cast every Thursday starting at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can either call on the phone, star 605-562-0444, just follow the directions, or call ID 17702. Or you can participate on the web, just go to the talk show website at www.talkshow.com. And search for Quality 17702 or SFU On Call or Starfleet Universe On Call, you shall find us there. Or if you want the best, the very best online experience, go over to twitch.tv. Yes, go over to twitch.tv, twitch.tv/SFU On Call, and you will find us there. You can join us for the live broadcast of this wonderful, wonderful podcast and be able to chat with your fellow Starfleet SFU On Call people. And of course, if you need to contact me for any reason, my email address is sfuoncall@gmail.com. That's sfuoncall@gmail.com. Also, if you want to, you can follow me on Twitter. My account there is sfuoncall while Twitter still exists. And of course, also my personal account is Paul France, PaulFranz. There's no T in that. And also, if you want my business account, which is Franz Games, FranzGames. Again, no T. And, of course, if you want to, this lovely podcast gets turned, TalkCast gets turned to a podcast available on various other feeds around the net. When it comes to ADB this week, it's been pretty quiet. I'd say too quiet. But probably not. I know the Steves are working hard work. I saw some minor posts about Mr. Patrick getting stuff into the computer that had not been in the computer yet. Some old stuff that was from way back before the dinosaurs roamed the earth. And he's working on getting that in. So, do a little touch typing to get him, keep him busy on things other than new products. Also, he is running the Sapphire Star Tournament. Just keep you a reminder about that. Also, of course, there's plenty of wonderful Prime Directive players can find multiple treasures on StarfleetGames.com. You can go there and you can find all kinds of wonderful stuff. Also, Starfleet Battle Force. There's some playtest cards on the website. Go to the main web, go to starfleetgames.com, go to Master Index, and you should be able to find it there. You can find all kinds of wonderful stuff, including desktop background images. You want to find some ones like of an Andromedan ship. And of course, moving onward and forward to the SFB Online Tournament, Sapphire Star 13 is the finals are going to be played. Now it's just down to the finals. It's going to be Kingzeal versus Mac Jack. That's going to be, the finals are going to be played April 21st, that's Friday night, at 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Yes, it is daylight time at this point. So, as EDT, or Eastern Time, for those people that all are on daylight saving time at this moment in time. When it comes to the client, not much going on there. When it comes to library report, not much going on there. I've gotten quite a few ships, but I need to go and process them, find the time and sit down and process those ships, both for the FedCom and SFB libraries. So with that is the news for this week. And it's me, as the one and only Paul Franz, welcoming you to Starfleet Universe On Call. And tonight, we've got me. We've got Gary. How you doing, Gary?
Not too bad. Hello, everybody.
Long time no hear.
Indeed so.
And don't mind me. Whatever. I'll figure it out later. But, and of course, Doug. How you doing, Doug?
Hi, I'm here. How are you?
Good, doing good. There. Okay, now time to mute all. Okay, turn that down. Okay, now I'm ready. Dang. Yeah, we're starting a little late today and getting things ready for tonight. Was my meeting for the sports association I'm a member of ran a little bit late today. So, and I had to renew my membership and all that kind of thing. So I had to stay a little later than normal. So, but anywho, Gary, is there a particular topic that you came to discuss or
I guess one thing I should mention is I don't know if you've had it covered in the news portion or not, but ADB recently announced on the BBS that they're working on the Orion Master Starship book for Star Trek Battles.
No, I missed that. Because I know they were working on other things, including getting some of the stuff that was not computerized yet into the computer, which was always a good thing. Of course, hopefully they'll have backups and backups for the backups and backups for the backups for the backups, you know. You never can have too many backups.
Well, there had been work on module R1 and R6 as well, but I'm not sure. I think with R1, I think their rule book is up, but the SSD book is not up just yet.
Mm-hmm.
R6, I don't believe, is up yet, but the Orion Master Starship book, apparently that's just the most recent thing that's going up, so I don't know what it's going to mean in terms of the publishing order. So,
mm-hmm.
But actually, I should probably check because I don't know if R1, because since R1 was published, some of the SSDs, if I recall correctly, in R1 are Empire specific, but others are for generic units. But I'm wondering, since there's been so many other additional Empires that have been added to the Alpha Octant.
Yeah.
You think about the Paravians and Carnivals and Module C6 and stuff. Hmm. Do they have to be incorporated the material from those empires into Module R1? Or is it still only the empires that were around at the time R1 itself was published?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Especially with, if I recall correctly, one of the things in Module R1 was the bases, correct? Like star bases, battle stations. I thought.
Yeah, I wouldn't bet on there being new SSDs for empires that hadn't gotten them the first time. So, like for example,
right.
The Paravians and Carnivans, I suspect that they probably have to wait for if they ever decide to do a module C6R that includes new ships and units for those empires. Maybe those could be going there. Or maybe they won't. Maybe they'll just tell people to just stick with the generic bases and
mm-hmm.
make do with them as best they can.
Yeah, but... Yeah, I was going to say about the bases was that, if I recall correctly, in module R1, the bases actually had a table saying, okay, you had the different weapons marked A, B, C, whatever. And they would say, okay, these weapons are disruptors, and these are phaser twos, and for the Klingons, for the Federation, these are photons, and these were phaser ones, things like that, where they had a generic chart for the empires at the time, for the bases, for like the star bases or the battle stations or the base stations, things like that. Mobile bases.
Actually, that just occurs to me, I think in the past we've talked about how some of the C6 weapons apply to starships, whether it's actually the Paravians or Carnivals themselves, or if it's pirate ships like the Orions or the Zosnan Marauders using some of those weapons. But if you think about it, it's probably a fair question to ask what effect the likes of disruptor cannons and quantum wave torpedoes and stuff have when it comes to base defense, because for one thing, I could probably think about how say if you have a Carnivon base, depending what the firing arcs are for the disruptor cannons, maybe that might help against the Andromedans, because the disruptor cannon has the same quote-unquote disruptive effect as a disruptor bolt.
Right.
So, and also if your base has lots of auxiliary warp reactors, then you'd probably be able to afford the overload cost more easily. Like if the Andro gets too close and you want to try to fill up the PA panels more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But then on the flip side, with the quantum wave torpedo, you've got the question. You've got the thing about like each individual torpedo is not going to hit any harder than it does for ship mounted launchers. But
right.
You've probably got more spare power in terms of being able to overload them if you want to. But then I don't know. I guess you'd have to check and see if the arcs don't overlap. Then is that necessarily helping you or not helping you? Because on ships, the arcs are usually 120 degrees. And if that applies for the bases as well, then you're not really in a position to concentrate your fire not either. So would that mean that a Peruvian base would be, relatively speaking, in more trouble? Or would the weight of fire from launching every turn be a factor in its own way?
Agreed. Well, that's I just have to wait and see, because I would think that that's the one thing is because their bases will the arcs change at all, is it purely a function of the weapon itself that they have the certain maximum arcs and that's it? You know, I'm not sure what the philosophy is when it comes to the weapons that are on ships. You know, does the limitations hold true for a star base or a battle station or base station?
Well, I'm trying to think now because I don't have it to hand, but in Module C6, in the rulebook portion, there is a section that does tell you how you adapt a generic base of whichever type to represent a Peruvian or Carnivon base. But I don't remember if the Carnivon base gets either the heel nippers or the death bolts as well, or if they only get the disruptor cannons.
Okay. Yeah, I don't have Module C6 at hand to look that up.
Well, that might be an interesting topic for another day.
Mm-hmm.
But, actually, now that I think about it, because we just mentioned that there's an Orion Master Starship book in the works, but that actually leads us to another question. Should the Master Starship book account for the Peruvian and Carnivon timelines? In the sense that, because Orion in Module C6, Orion pilots are allowed to use quantum wave torpedoes and disruptor cannons, but they're barred from using death bolts or heel nippers. And also, there's the question in terms of which cartel has access to which weapon system. Because there's only one of them that treats Peruvian territory as a home territory if you're using the MAPSHIP P timeline. But then on the other hand, if you are in the Carnivon Empire timeline, that's the one where the Carnivons are still on the map, like they haven't taken over the wind cluster, then you still have winds and a cluster cartel as normal. So because they're an adjacent empire, do they basically get added on to the, you know, the way like the wind, the cluster cartel Orions currently treat the three surrounding empires as an expanded home territory? So they get equal access to all three. So does that become equal access to all four in the sense that if you play the cluster Orions in that timeline, you get disruptor cannons as a home weapon as opposed to an imported weapon?
Understood. Yeah, that's a good question. Whether it's going to have that available in the book or not, at least having it as an option in the book that they say, yeah, well, if you're... Oh, yeah. I would think that they would go through, they would stick to the main timeline, and maybe at the back of the book, say these, you know, if you follow these alternate timelines, you know, these are the adjustments that are made. That I would think that's the way it would play out when it comes to the Master Shipbook for the Orions.
Okay. Maybe, because I'm trying to think the other. Well, actually, no, because the Borak and Paladine, because the Paladine, they just use, like, I guess, quote unquote, regular weapons anyway. And the Borak, I think if, even if you use them as a regular Empire, I think a lot of their weapons are unique to them, so there's relatively few of them that an Orion can take. But then those two Empires are still technically playtests. So they're not as far along as the Module C6 Empires in terms of being, quote unquote, formally published.
Right.
So I wouldn't necessarily say that they matter as much in terms of being in the Master Starship book.
It's not like it was the module C4, the training. Training something. Training center.
Yeah. So actually, you know, it just occurred to me that Module R4J itself has a couple of alternate timelines, and in one of those, the Paravians actually become the main pirate faction. So basically, what it means is that they use the ships that the Orion pirates use in the standard timeline, except that every Paravian cartel, so to speak, has automatically gets quantum wave torpedoes as a home technology on top of whatever technology they're lifting from the locals.
So if okay, that brings up a question that you know, and I don't know, which is about the origin timeline where the Paravians are basically are the Orions, basically. They're the pirates of the Alpha Octant. And in that case, do they basically perform the same not go Yankees. They perform the same function, i.e. they have the ability to they have option mounts so they can select different weapons based on where they're located. The Paravian cartel is located. Is that what happens?
Yeah, that's basically yeah. In that timeline, they basically kind of become like basically the only real difference is retaining the access to the quantum wave torpedo. But aside from that, they use standard Orion engine doubling and option mounts
Oh,
and
okay.
all that kind of stuff. So yeah, you can still go with like plasma if you're in a plasma empire or disruptors if you're in a disruptor empire, that sort of thing.
Okay. But
But
okay, in that
yeah, so
timeline,
actually, you think about that.
I was gonna ask, in that timeline though, do the basically are the Orions basically just Paravians? I mean, meaning do they use the same ship as the Orions?
Yeah, that timeline basically just gives them, it basically just says that the Orions in that universe, they never become the Orions as we know them. So they basically just, I think they use standard Federation ships or whatever. So in their place, the Paravians spread across the Alpha Octants and developed the same kind of technology for piracy that our Orions would have in the standard timeline.
Right. But do they use the same ships or do they have or they use Paravian ships that just are modified to have option mounts? And just have the same technology as the Orions.
It's basically the same SSDs that you would use in the standard timeline for the Orions. So they basically, at that point, they would have given up using their own ships.
Oh, okay.
Because I think they still lose the home world in that timeline. So they have no home base, like their main shipyard has been destroyed.
Right.
And so they have to basically follow the same kind of decentralized system that the Orion pirates use in the standard timeline. I think it's basically meant to be more, I guess you could say, form follows function.
Oh,
Like
okay.
they need these pirate ships to do the same things that the Orion pirates would have, ships needed to do. And so they basically end up more or less in the same route. At least that's the way Module R4J says it. So
Right.
whether you'd agree with that from my story, but that's how that particular timeline presents the option.
Understood. That would be interesting. because of the question is, would the Praevens really give up their designs, their ships, or would they be more of, in that case, a merging, you know, a kind of fusion of Praevian and Orion ships? You know, yeah, there's some modification to the ship to allow it to have those Orion what was previously the Orion technologies, but it was still the ships would kin back to the original Praevian ships. You know, so it wasn't purely formed.
Part of it is
based on function.
But yeah, I think part of it is that in the Alpha Octave, at least, there are certain design trade-offs that you have to do, you have to follow, in order to be able to field a ship that has the reduced electronic signature that a pirate ship has, in the sense that you get the plus 2 ECM, and you basically end up with a narrower profile and certain coating that you have to apply and so on. So you kind of basically have to move away from the kind of design that we would use. Now, you're not wrong in the sense that even a regular Praevian ship is designed to be a pseudo-pirate. Like, mm-hmm. most of them can land on planets. They've got large boarding party complements. And they have weapons that are pretty good at you know, taking down freighters and stuff, whatever, and setting up boarding actions. But they're still full-size ships.
Mm-hmm.
That require a full-size construction yard. So, and they don't necessarily have any stealth bonus. So it'll be a lot harder for them to hide what they're doing. So, if only for that, it's the same reason, basically, because in the standard timeline, the very earliest Orion pirates that defect from Orion, the homeworld,
mm-hmm.
is 113, they actually use the same ships for piracy that the Orion National Guard used for local defense.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only like later that they gave up those designs to move towards the prototypes of the light raider and raider cruiser that we're more familiar with in the modern era. So the whole reason why the modern pirate ships that we know of came about is because just basically repurposing the National Guard ships for piracy was not sufficient to suit the pirates' purposes.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the logic that's being applied to this alternate timeline is that it's actually the Praevians who see themselves in that same situation, where they're the ones that have to go through that, I guess you could call it a painful transition. But in another sense, it might not necessarily be that painful, because they're already used to the concept of having ships that can land on planets and so forth. So, I mean, maybe if you were doing a Shapeways miniature, it might not look exactly the same as the ones that the Orions build.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of, because think about it, a lot of the generic SSDs that exist in the universe, like, for example, like a Free Trader or a Priority Transport,
mm-hmm.
Or even like a Starbase. In reality, in the actual universe, they look different empire by empire. But in terms of how they function in game terms, they're identical.
Right.
Except for like the weapon hunts or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably something similar. I mean, in one's mind's eye, you could probably see the Praevian pirate versions of these ships as being more kind of Praevian-esque in terms of their layout,
mm-hmm.
but in practical terms, you wouldn't need to create a whole bunch of new SSDs to play them.
Right. So, you know, they might have some perfunctory, you know, wings, but they don't follow any true function. They're more of like tail fins. In the old cars, you know, they really didn't perform any true function. It was just for look of in the case of the car, but in the case of the previous, maybe the look of the ship, you know.
But yeah, so actually, yeah, so it'll be interesting to see, will the Orion Master Starship book basically kind of like, because think about it like this, when the Tholian Master Starship book came out, it actually doubled down on the Home Galaxy material, has a lot of additional, it and Modular 4T include a lot of additional material about what the Tholian Empire actually looked like in the Home Galaxy just before the revolt. Not just in terms of the ships they used, but in terms of the support units and also what kind of civilian units that the subjugated planets used, like the ones who basically provided the supplies that the Tholians needed to build more dyson spheres and stuff, and what ships they were allowed to use, like what shuttles they were used and so forth, and what because some of them were given a small number of auxiliaries because there was piracy in M81 as well, and so the Tholians didn't necessarily want to bother doing, sorting it out all by themselves or letting the Sartorians do it. There was sometimes like an intermediate step where a less distrusted planet might be allowed to use like a certain number of armed auxiliaries to try to ward off pirate raids by themselves, but not so trusted enough that they'd be able to use those to launch a rebellion. So there was that kind of balancing act that they would have. And but yeah, that's basically additional material that can now be leveraged for like a future product. Like I suspect that, or at least I hope that if we ever get a Sartorian Master Starship book, it'll basically offer the next step in terms of helping to flesh out the home galaxy as like a functional environment. And then that maybe in the future might make a standalone M81 product more capable of working as an actual campaign compatible setting. So for that reason alone, I wonder. I mean, it's a different story because those still happened in the historical timeline, whereas in the Orion case, they're kind of alternate timelines. But still, I mean, like, we'll have to wait and see. I mean, I suppose there's only one way to find out.
Agreed, agreed. Since I don't remember you us talking since this happened, which is the release of the gunboats, FedCom gunboats, and the gunboats attack, I think is the module. And of course, in my mind, the big issue for me as a FedCom fan is that they're not going to be selling ship cards, physical ship cards at the moment. Basically, due to cost, to keep up the quality of the ship cards themselves, which to me is disappointing. But I haven't, I don't think we, you and I ever talked about Gunboat's attack, after it was released. So, what do you think of it?
Well, definitely. It's definitely an interesting product. It's got the Andromeda Adder in it, and it's actually led to a couple of interesting because there have been various hailing frequencies extras that have been uploaded since. Like there's a ship card now for the Federation F-111. I didn't think that was going to happen, and it's very kind of I guess you could call it restricted in its deployment. But there actually is, I don't know if you've seen it already, but there actually is going to be some errata for the Adder PF for the Andromedans, basically allowing them to take them, instead of, because with other empires, they can take a number of PFs based on how many full-size ships they have. And I guess if you look under the bonnet, it kind of maps to the allowances that casual PFs give you in FFB, although, of course, they won't use that for. But with the Andromedans, that doesn't fly because unless you've got the Andromedan monitors, which aren't in FedCom yet, you need to transport the PFs the same way that you would with mobile weapon platforms from FFB, which is basically internally. So there is an errata note that's been posted to the Gunboat Attack feedback, like after action reports in, where they're basically going to revise the rulebook to give them basically the same kind of availability and restrictions as most standard. I think you can still only take as many as six. But as long as you've got the hangar space for them, you can take them.
Understood. Yeah, I brought it up, and I see back in February that Steve Cole said, and I quote, add to rules. Andromeda adders are deployed differently from any other gunboats. Big surprise. While there may be no more than six in any given force, they're not restricted by the number of ship present. I think that should be ships, not ship. As described in FW5W2A. Instead, using Andromeda satellite rules 5V1 for carriage and deployment, each adder requires one hangar point. Whoa, a full hangar point? 5V1A.
Yeah, so, bear in mind that in FedCom terms, it's 3, 4, and 6 hangar points. For a Viper, a Cobra, or a Mamba, respectively.
Okay.
And that actually matches what a mobile weapon platform or yeah. An adder takes up over in the Starfleet battle as well. So it's fine.
Mm-hmm. Oh, agreed. I don't remember reading the FedCom rules when it comes to satellite ships. I was more concerned when I was reading the rules was more of the interaction of the PA panels, make sure the PA panels still worked relatively the same as SFB and a function of that with the batteries of the Andromedans. Since I know when it comes to the Andromedan energy system, it is quite a bit different than the regular ships, Milky Way ships, even extra Milky Way ships. But the point being that with the differences when it comes to the Andromedas, and definitely with FedCom. The way it is played is different, when it comes to phasers and there's no phaser capacitor in FedCom. You fire the phaser directly from how much energy that you have available for the ship. So that changes things when it comes to energy, the energy usage completely. And the question is, how does that sync up? With the Andromedans, because the Andromedans is supposed to be a closed loop system. So that was my main focus when I was reading the Andromedan rules for FedCom, and I didn't really read about the satellite ships and number of hangar points that each ship has a specific one. Which previously, when it comes to SFB, you actually had to have your hangars configured a certain way. For example, if you had two of the medium satellite ships, large satellite ships, the Python, which is actually is a satellite ship, but it took up 1.5 hangars and hangar base. And in that case, what you'd actually have to do is have it so that mothership was configured that way. So it wasn't like the hangar bays were actually one just big open space. Actually, there were separated hangar bays, within the ship itself. And that makes sense, for FedCom, if they actually use hangar points, which it's more flexible. It is relatively, it's easier. Obviously it's simplified. It's easier to understand and it doesn't have some limitations that are placed upon people who are playing the Andromedans in SFB. I.e., in my mind,
yeah,
that means that you could had that same satellite ship that has like two of the large satellite ships, like two Pythons. If we can hold that, which definitely I think the Dominator could do that, you can actually have it so that then if you had more smaller satellite ships, you actually could also load them into that same ship. You know, so I worked a little different.
Yeah, Fedcom doesn't need to, you don't need to worry about hangar configurations in terms of mixing and matching your satellite ships or recovering them for that matter. So, say if one mothership brings Cobras and the other one brings Mambos,
mm-hmm.
then either can recover the other satellite ships if they need to.
Understood. Yeah. Which to me is it's a wonderful advantage. Of course, I have rarely. It's not that I haven't played it, but I've rarely played Andromedas with the actual motherships. The only one was a campaign game. I still remember playing it because of I did something which I thought was kind of inventive myself, which was it we had you know, scouts. And to have it so that the Andromedan scout, which was an eel, you know, relatively small, it was a satellite ship, it could actually use as much power as possible to use it for EW. What I did was I checked on the rules first before I tried this and make sure I wasn't doing anything illegal, which was I took the satellite ship and I attached a tractor from the mothership to the satellite ship and just had the mothership just drag the satellite ship all around wherever it went. Yeah, the mothership went slower and took more power to move it, to move around the board because of basically the movement cost of the ship had increased by 2/3, which makes things really... actually, it wasn't bad because of, I think, I forget if it was in, not Infestor, but an Intruder. I think it might have been an Intruder. It wasn't, yeah, I don't think it was a Dominator. I think it was an Intruder. So it means that movement cost was 1 2/3 movement cost, which is not too bad to calculate out. You know, I thought it worked out pretty well, you know. So, because Lord knows the eel doesn't have that much power. And if you want it to use, you know, be able to support the other ships using EW, you don't want it using its batteries because that means you only can use the batteries for so long before the batteries are completely drained. And that's why I was thinking about, that's why I did what I did, which was basically drag the scout along. The only way to get around that one is actually making the mothership your scout, which is basically what happens with if you had like PF tenders, if you had carriers, but I don't think carriers. The carriers ever really have special sensors? I don't think.
Well, I think the Andromedan motherships you're thinking of might be the Infestor and Missionary.
Mm-hmm.
Those have special sensors and mark their hangar bays.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
If you're talking about scout carriers, yeah, because the Federation needs those to go after the RTN. Like, for example, the GVX has its.
Right.
The same special sensors as the GVX.
Right. I was talking about a standard carrier. A standard carrier didn't have special sensors, but a PF tender would. Overall, it would actually have special sensors. If I'm recalling this correctly, it's been a while, I'll be honest.
Well, the thing is, though, is that strategically speaking, it's not necessarily a good idea trade-off for the Andromedans because they really need those mothership variants to reinforce the RTN. right? Because they need to make sure that they're able to basically keep as many bases in play and also relocate them if necessary, and also upgrade them to base stations or battle stations or construction battle stations and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily, they don't have the flexibility that an Alpha or Omega Empire has in terms of assigning, like converting some of their warships to those kind of mission variants, because the more that they use on the line, then the weaker they're going to make themselves in the campaign overall. So
right, right.
It's technically, I mean, if you're only concerned about SFB, then like duels, I should say, in SFB, then maybe it's something worth considering. But if you're playing any sort of campaign, it might not be the best idea to lean too heavily towards using your infestors or missionaries as satellite ship tenders, in combat, rather than using them as base support variants.
Right. I understand. At a strategic level, yeah, you don't want to waste those ships, you know, versus one of the smaller scouts, whether it's a courier or an eel or what was the one? Darn it. There was one where it was one of the large satellite ships. The Mamba class.
The Anaconda.
Anaconda, thank you. Yeah.
Actually, just to get back to the Orion for one more second.
Yeah, sure, by all means.
One thing that I would think would actually be really welcome in the Master Starship book would be a more... Because, as I say, we were just talking earlier about how the Tholian Master Starship book really thickens out our understanding of the home galaxy. And also it consolidates all of the material for the Tholians in the early years, too. So you're getting basically three... ish distinct settings in terms of like the material you need to run them properly. But for the Orions, if you look at some of the I think module R8 and also the various Y modules, the Orion National Guard ships, they're not even the ones that stay loyal to the Orion Enclave. They're still published under R8. They're not published under the Federation R section, like R2, like the same way that the Vulcan or Andorian or Terran ships are. So even if, like, I think actually, like, if you wanted to try to basically flesh out what the Orion Enclave is like as a government,
mm-hmm.
and what kind of responsibilities they have within the Enclave, and especially, like, two major things is, what did they do when they went neutral during the General War? And also, how did they adapt to the Andromedan War? Because it's one thing because the Klingons and Romulans were willing to accept the neutrality of the Orion Enclave for the duration of that period of their history.
Right, so because of it benefited them.
So they only had to worry about local defense issues, and to include basically hiring mercenary Orion pirate ships to help, you know, keep monsters and, you know, other kind of things at bay. But the Andromedans don't care about any of that. I mean, they'd be more than happy to conquer Orion and just get rid of the National Guard entirely.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not good business for the pirates who were in Orion, in the Orion Enclave. And it's also not good business for Starfleet either, because, like, they'd have to be able to intervene into the Enclave to try to fight off any large-scale Andromedan incursion. So that would actually open up some big questions in terms of what is the political side of all this? Because the other thing, too, is even though the Orions came back into the Federation, do they still have the same bespoke deal that they had before? Or are there like a different set of circumstances? Like, does the rest of the Federation, are they not particularly... Well, they probably aren't particularly happy over what happened either. So... How differently is Orion, the planet, and also the Enclave, going to function through the end of the Andromedan War? And would this product be a good place to try to hash out those things and basically have it formalized for the first time? Or is it better to wait until the future issue of Captain Vlog and have it come up as like an article then and focus the Master Starship book on the Lions as Pirates?
I actually bring up a question which I don't know, which is when it comes to the Master Starship books, do they focus mainly just on the ships, or do they actually extend it to the actual background material of that empire? Because I never bought a Master Starship book. Not yet, anyway.
Well, most of them, the ones I've seen so far, they don't have to, because, like, if you get the Klingon Starship book, I mean, the Klingon Empire is pretty well defined. So
right.
Just like the only thing it's really missing is anything about the Vudar. But then, of course, I guess in theory, the Vudar would just get their own separate book later.
Right, and then there's subjugated. Well, the other races that are within the Klingon Empire.
So yeah, none of the other species that are subject to the Klingons have their own ships the way the Vudar do. So
right, that is
you
true.
You don't really have to worry about that.
Right, that's why I was talking. We'll talk about background material, not necessarily focused on the ships. I mean, completely focused on the ships.
In the case of the Federation, with the exception of the Orion ships, like all of the other National Guard ships, you basically subsume them, I guess, into either the earlier ships, for the ones that they built separately, or the modern National Guard ships are basically just Y-era saucer and Michelle ships that have been handed down to the National Guards. So, you don't necessarily have to worry to the same extent. But with the Tholians, they went to the point of the Tholian Master Starship book does actually include a number of background articles that had been published in Captain's Log. Particularly when it comes to the earlier Tholians, because that material is presented to help explain why the rules for the earlier Tholians are as distinct as they are. So, for example, it gives you a list of the various earlier freighters that they use on the basis, and the background material explains that the reason why they're using those freighters is because they lost greater technology, because even back in the home galaxy, the Tholians didn't build their own freighters. They let their subject planets build them because it was like work that the Tholians didn't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So when they showed up in our galaxy as exiles, they basically had to resort to capturing early years Klingon freighters and using those. So but then you have to ask yourself, like, well, why are they doing this? And then that's why the Captain's Log articles are included, because then it gives you, like, a sense of just how urgent the situation was for the Tholians in that time period. And so that basically explains why, in Starfleet battle terms, you can only do X, Y, Z instead of A, B, C.
Mm-hmm.
So that part is actually really interesting. I think the further into the Master Starship book project they go, I think the more this sort of thing is going to start coming up. Because actually, here's another one. They haven't said anything about a Wind Cluster Master Starship book. But even before you get there, there is the question of the alliance of the Wind Cluster. Because as an actual faction in and of themselves, they are also a factor. Now, so you basically have to start kind of wondering, well, how many, because of the ships that defend the Wind Cluster at any given time,
right,
how many of those are Wind Orion ships that the Orions have sold to, or given to the Winds, or sold to them? And so it's actually Wind crews who are flying them. And how many of them are Orion pirate ships that are under the control of the Cluster Cartel that are helping out because they don't want to lose their shipyard either.
Right.
And this not just like during the General War, like when the the coalition empires try to barge in and take over the place. But like when the ISC or the Andromedans come along, at what point are there enough ships to mean that if you're drawing up a scenario, you need to have those Orion ships accounted for on top of the Wind Navy ships that are there to, you know, defend the place.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's actually a very different thing too, because most of the time when you're running an Orion, like cartel or whatever in the game, your bases are hidden. So you're basically below the map in Federation and Empire terms.
Right.
But that doesn't apply to the cluster cartel because everyone knows where they are and they know, you know, in theory, they know how to get to them. In practice, it's a lot trickier. But so in a sense, the Orions in the cluster, they're a little bit more like a traditional empire in the sense that they have a fixed shipyard that they can't move at all. They can't would appear on that scale. And so you've got that kind of weird, zone that they're in terms of accounting for them in a product like this. So, but of course, that makes it more interesting. I mean, like, that's another reason why you'd want to buy the book, because I mean, you probably need the Orion book. If you're a Wind player, like, you wouldn't just get the Wind Master Starship book. You have the Orion one as well, because you can't really have one without the other. So.
Understood. But I think the main thing there is it only makes a difference in my mind anyway if we're talking about in more of a strategic game versus purely tactical, where it's just scenario after scenario, there's no context, as the deal, which in the case of a strategic game, then context means everything. And I agree that when it comes to the history of the Wind cluster, historically the Winds in that cluster does not want to go away. They don't want to give up their very advantageous situation that they have. They have a place that they can hide and are basically protected inside, because they're inside the Wind cluster. So if you have a local empire, whether it's the Klingons or the Zinni, who are chasing after a pirate ship, and they dive into the Wind cluster, they're basically safe. They're not going to have a single ship go after that single Orion ship. I would think it would be a rare thing that either Empire, Klingons or Zinni, would actually want to send in an actual large enough force to get, destroy or even just attack the Orion ship or get back whatever the Orion ship stole. That made them want to come into the Wind cluster to begin with. Doug. Please jump in. Doug?
Yeah, go ahead.
No, go on.
Basically, I totally agree that going in there is basically suicide for the Navy ships on an individual basis.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they have their scenarios where you go in and you've got all these different minuses, I should say, debuffs to your ship.
Right. And invariably, it's when it comes to actually combat, that you have an outside ship wanting to come in, it's usually not to get another ship that's inside the Wind cluster because of plain simple reason that you're going to be out of commission. Come into the Wind cluster and the Winds know you're coming. So, basically, what you're doing is just they'll easily capture your ship or blow it up, either one, whatever they want to do, for entering their territory. I can see them capturing and going, "Oh, thank you for the nice ship. We'll see what we can do with it." Guys, remember the pocket battleship, which is an interesting ship, to say the very least. But yeah, that's the thing I've rarely done, which actually is play the Orions, because of whether it's tournament play or in a campaign, it's a rare thing to do. I think I played it in a scenario one time where what we did was we'd have two sides of the battle for four players, and we would team up. Each player would pick at their own empire, and in one case someone picked the Orions and played, but I forget who they, what was the other empire on that side, I forget, but you always have that. Those are always a bad thing overall, because of that was one thing. So when I was playing that one campaign with the Andromedans that I was flying in against, which is the most nastiest combination, the Federation and the Hydrants. The Federation takes their photons and knocks down your shield. The Hydrants then come in and go, "Oh, here's a Hellborg. Think just have some more, some more damage just right there, So it's definitely a deadly combination, those two empires flying together, at least in a campaign. Yeah, so. Mind you, I enjoyed playing in the campaign, a couple being a captain, here and there, And that's actually one of the things I got to do, is get caught up on some of the updates to the ships that Frank is using. Because, invariably, Frank LeMay, who is in a never-ending campaign, at least it seems like that he, they find issues with the ships by playing them, which is, hey, please play more. I want you to find every single issue that we have with all the ships that we currently have and go from there. This is all the 3D converted ships that they're playing with. And invariably, they'll find an issue here, or find an issue there. In some cases, the issue that they find is not because of, it's basically because of the way they did the conversion. Is what they did, and they didn't understand some of the support and how things worked within the client itself. Unlike Aaron Staley, who he knew the tool very, very, very well. He worked at the very beginning, and it was always awesome to see the consistency of the product he created was always nice. Nice to have. And Lord knows, even after he did the whole library one time, he started from the beginning again and redoing the whole library all over again to make sure, tweaks here, make it look better, make it have more information available, and this is what got us in trouble. So it is what it is. Sorry, got a train. Okay, I think with that, we will close it up for the evening. Gary, it's been wonderful to have you around. You have a good night.
Have a night, Paul.
Okay. Doug. The quiet one. Hey, that's fine. You know, you don't always have to be number one talking partner, I guess you can call it that way. But anyhow, you have a good night.
You too. Thank you.
So tonight we got into talking about, you know, the Orion Master Starship book, and also this just encourages people go there. That was one thing I did find out. While we were chatting, one thing I was like, okay, wait a minute, are these available on the e-tailers? And guess what? They are actually. That I just hit the wrong one, didn't I? I want that one, but I want. So that's one. For those watching, you can see it. Here's got the Tholian, the Gorn, the Federation, the Klingon, the Hydran, the Zinni, the Lyran, the Romulan, the LDR, which to me, when it comes to LDR versus Lyran, there ain't that much of a difference. Except for, you know, there are some differences because of the LDRs have the Gatling phasers. So there's some differences there. Mainly, in my mind, is that the availability of ships was more limited in the LDR versus the Lyran. And that is it. You know, there's more GURPS Traveler Classic first in, which is interesting. Anyhow, I figured you might want to see that. But, you know, that's the Master Starship books there, so by all means, purchase some of the ebooks. Actually, what I'm thinking about doing is, not tonight, because I got too many things to get done after I log off here, which is maybe tomorrow, is go and buy that Tholian Master Starship book, because that sounded really interesting. Of course, first thing I have to do is make sure I didn't already purchase it. that would not be the first time that I bought the same book multiple times. So with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.